At Sunstone, we are making it a goal to build community that allows many ways to for people to express their faith. Our recent tagline is, "There is more than one way to Mormon." We invite you to help us build community where all paths are given space to be better understood. What this means is we all get to practice feeling challenged. At this conference, you might hear things you agree with, things that inspire you, and things that will help you grow. Growth can be experienced in many ways. As you go through the conference and encounter ideas all over the spectrum of belief, we invite you to employ empathy as your standard of engagement. We are so very pleased you decided to join us at this conference. We hope you enjoy this session and the sessions to come. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. How's my volume? Can you hear me back in the back? Okay. If you haven't already, please consider subscribing to Sunstone Magazine at the registration desk as well. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both the audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As you can see from your program, this presentation description is as follows. In this paper, Todd Compton will tell the story of how he came to write In Sacred Loneliness, the plural wives of Joseph Smith. For years, he had been studying classics, ancient Greek and Latin, but a series of odd accidents led him to start transcribing and annotating the diaries of Eliza R. Snow. This, in turn, led him to come up with a reliable, scholarly list of Joseph Smith's wives so he could understand the women Eliza was associating with. To create that list, he found that he needed to understand the full lives of those 33 women, and so ended up reading their diaries, letters, and autobiographies. Eventually, he began writing biographies of each of them. Problems and complexities in their marriage history led him on an exciting scholarly detective quest. In addition, their writings were so moving that he ended up feeling deeply connected to each of them. Lindsay Hansen Park will then discuss how Compton's work has shaped the landscape of Mormonism. Lindsay is the host of the Year of Polygamy podcast and executive director of Sunstone Educational Foundation. Todd has written In Sacred Loneliness, The Plural Wives of Joseph Smith, A Frontier Life, Jacob Hamlin, Explorer and Indian Missionary, and Who Wrote the Beatles Songs, which he'll be presenting on later, A History of Lennon McCartney, and other books and articles. He is currently preparing a sequel to In Sacred Loneliness, concentrating on the writings of Smith's wives. He lives in the Bay Area, California, with his wife, my daughter, Laura, and their two sons, working as an ADS specialist at a law firm. He's also my favorite son-in-law. And when he's done, Lindsay will present her love letter to In Sacred Loneliness.
I'm writing, I'm going to read parts of an article I wrote for this book, edited by Joe Geisner, and he asked me to write an article on how I came to write In Sacred Loneliness. So I am just covering the writing of the book, nothing about what happened after it was published. I guess Lindsay is going to cover some of that. And so this book looks great, doesn't it? So I'm going to read a little bit about it. A compilation of 15 essays written specifically for this new volume. Well-known Mormon historians tell their story of writing books that have influenced our understanding of the Mormon past, and they also give us a glimpse into why they wrote these important books. The volume's contributors include Vicki Speak, Will Bagley, D. Michael Quinn, William McKinnon, Polly Aird, John Turner, Gregory Prince, Brian Hales, Susan Staker, George D. Smith, Daniel Stone, Melvin Johnson, Linda K. Newell, and myself. So that'll be a great book. Okay, and so here's something you can look at while I begin this story. Okay, the actual article in the book will be called Plural Accidents, Writing in Sacred Loneliness. Okay, In Sacred Loneliness, The Plural Wise of Joseph Smith, published by Signature Books in 1997, was written as a result of a series of odd accidents. There was nothing logical or predictable that would have led me to write In Sacred Loneliness. Circumstances in our lives are sometimes the result of mysterious odd accidents, and here's how this particular chain of unlikely events took place. And I should give you just a little bit of background. I was, I guess I would call myself a somewhat liberal Mormon, but I got really interested in the Mormon scholar Hugh Nibley, you know, who wrote a lot about proving the ancient, you know, the Mormon scriptures as ancient texts. And so he was my, you know, my main influence through most of my graduate student years. And I went to UCLA and got a PhD there because there was a person there who did comparative myth, which I really liked. Okay, and I liked Mormon history, but I didn't do any research in it and wasn't focused on it at all. Okay, after finishing my PhD at UCLA in 1988, I taught classics for a year across town at USC, classics being ancient Greek and Latin. I knew it was not a permanent job. It was something that might help me get an appointment someplace else. But as my time at USC came to an end, my employment prospects were not looking good. Jobs in classics were scarce. It was a difficult time in my life, as it was starting to look like everything I had been working for would not come to fruition. It was emotionally devastating. I would have to find some non-teaching jobs somehow. I began doing temp jobs in Los Angeles to get by. I was single, attending singles wards in the L.A. and Santa Monica area. I had a friend in the L.A. First Ward named Janet Ellingson, and she ended up moving back to Utah, then out of the blue started a doctoral program in American history at the University of Utah. As a history student, she applied for and received a summer grant from the Henry Huntington Library in Southern California, San Marino, near Pasadena, which has a marvelous collection of documents in American history and a sizable collection of Mormon documents. So in summer 1991, Janet was back in our small group of friends in the LA First Ward, and the Huntington was paying her to go read Mormon documents full-time in their library and archives every day for a couple of months. As for me, I was trying to get my doctoral thesis on scapegoat poets into shape so I could get it published. I thought if a good university press accepted it, I might be able to find a job in classics. At this point, Janet suggested that I apply to the Huntington Library to receive a summer fellowship. The Huntington had the Overland Diaries of Eliza Snow, she said. She told me, why don't you apply to work on them? And Janet followed this up by sending me a letter and suggesting things I could write in the application. So she basically is writing the application for me. Here's a quote from it. Here's the info for the Huntington Fellowships. I've been thinking about the E.R. Snow Diaries and have decided the project would be worth doing. Not that my opinion matters much. And hope you seriously pursue the project. I think Snow's experience would work well to identify gender boundaries and issues of male-female authority, end quote. And I thought this was a crazy idea, you know, and I still think it was a crazy idea. I had no background in Mormon history. I had no background in women in Mormon history. My research interests were centered in ancient myth and history. I had no inclination to work on the E.R. Snow Diaries and no qualifications for getting the fellowship. You know, and I've applied to many fellowships and that I was really well qualified for me, and they just turned me away, you know. But I looked the application over. It didn't look like it would take too much work. And I spent an hour or so finishing the application, sometimes quoting directly from Janet's letter to me. And I wrote some quick letters to people I knew for recommendations and sent the application in. I wouldn't get it, I knew. I had no background in Mormon history, which was obvious when I sent in my CV. So we now have two improbable events. One, that Janet would come up with the idea to encourage me to apply for a grant to work on the diaries of Eliza R. Snow. And two, that I would actually take her advice and apply for the grant. After I sent off the application, I completely forgot about it, as I knew I wouldn't receive it. And of course, the third improbable event happened. To my complete surprise, a few months later, out of the blue, I got a letter from the Huntington that informed me that I had been awarded a summer grant to work on the diaries of Eliza R. Snow. I was floored, but I thought it sounded fun, you know? So I would be paid to go to the wonderful Huntington Library and study there. So in summer 1992, I entered that library as a visiting fellow. The Huntington is a paradise for scholars, a fabulous repository of literary and historical documents and rare books, surrounded by the gorgeous Huntington Gardens. And by some mysterious quirk of fate, I was being paid to go there, read all day, for a couple months. And Janet's bizarre plan that I knew would never work somehow had succeeded. Of course, I realized now I would have to do something with the Snow Diaries. It was a great moment when I entered the reading room in the Huntington with its long desks and bookcases with rare books set up. And I set up my primitive gray laptop computer and ordered the Eliza R. Snow Diaries. I was given one of two little volumes and sat down to read it. It was exciting. Snow had sat by the campfire at night and written her daily report in this very notebook I was holding. The entries were in her neat, precise handwriting and in her really individual literary style, so different from the great majority of the Mormon documents I would read later, because it was quite educated in style. For example, here is one day from that diary. Okay. And as we read through this, note how much is kind of enigmatic, especially the names of the people. Monday, August 23rd, 1847, this morning, Sister P broiled some buffalo meat, which Captain M killed yesterday, but it seemed to have been the father of all buffaloes and uneatable. We start at 8 with Captain N. You know, that's an interesting thing about Eliza R. Snow. Sometimes she seems very stiff and educated, but then there's these wonderful flashes of humor. Okay, but let me go on. We start at 8 with Captain N in front and President Y and Captain G in the rear. Well, at least you know who President Y is, right? Okay. In about 3 miles, cross a stream, come onto the Platte in about 8 miles, which seems like meeting an old friend. Find an inscription, 90 miles to Fort Johns. Go 2 miles, cross Deer Creek, bait and dine. A dish of tea is very acceptable. The day is clear, the road pretty smooth, but very hilly and barren. A windy thunderstorm before night. Travel 15 miles. Okay? So when you read the works of Homer or Herodotus, as I had been doing, you're reading copies of copies of copies, manuscripts dating to the Middle Ages, long after the author had lived. Here I was reading an actual handwritten manuscript made by the author herself on the actual day the events had occurred. So it was an exciting contrast. So I began typing a transcript to the diaries and started to annotate it, try to figure out what all of these words meant, you know, including the names of the people. Okay, so there were many entries in Snow's journal that identified people in a kind of shorthand, instantly understandable to Snow herself or to her friends, but to a modern reader with no knowledge of Snow's life, incomprehensible. For example, here's another one. Tuesday, June 1st, 1847. This is truly a glorious time with mother and daughters in Zion, although thrust out from the land of our forefathers and from the endearments of civilized life. This forenoon made a cap for Sister Pierce. In the afternoon visited at Sister Miller's in the company of Priscinda, Zina, Sister Chase, Christine, and etc. After supper, Sister Whitney, Kimball, Sessions came in, and we had a spiritual feast in very deed. And sometimes she would simply give an initial such as Sister C. So I'm just giving you an example of how she referred to other women and other people. And, you know, if you're Eliza R. Snow, it's obvious who these people are, you know. But if you're a modern reader, often it's not clear at all. To understand the people mentioned in passages like this, I found that lists of related people were useful. For women, I know that Eliza had been a plural wife of Joseph Smith and was at the time of the Overland Diary a plural wife of Brigham Young. Therefore, it would be helpful to get good, reliable lists of Smith's and Young's wives. I also knew that Snow had many friends among the plural wives of Heber C. Kimball, Brigham Young's right-hand man, and counselor in the governing First Presidency. These lists would intersect, as many of Smith's widows married Young and Kimball. So I went to the secondary literature in search of such lists. For Young, I found lists and analyses of wives and families by Jeffrey Johnson and others. For Heber C. Kimball, there's a great appendix in Stanley Kimball's biography of Heber C. Kimball. But the only scholarly list of Joseph Smith's wives I could find was a long appendix to Fawn Brodie's controversial biography, No Man Knows My History. While this list was useful, it was also problematic. It was half a century old, compiled in 1945, long before the recent modernization and partial opening of the LDS Church archives in the 1970s. As a result, it was lacking many primary sources now available, and sometimes used sources that did not seem reliable. Some women were listed as Smith's wives who really weren't reliably documented. In one case, she listed one woman twice, because she had married five times, and so she was known by different last names in different documents. So I've criticized these mistakes, but I think she deserves credit, as it was a pioneering list, sometimes flawed, but no LDS, you know, conservative LDS scholar had tried to do something similar. And I think that shows that in the half century since her book was published, Joseph Smith's Nauvoo polygamy had become a taboo subject of sorts. Therefore, I started making my own list of Smith's plural wives. At first, this was purely to help me identify the women in Snow's diary. I realized I would need as a basis good evidence that the woman married Smith during his lifetime. And many women were married to Joseph Smith after he died, so I wasn't even looking at them. Ideally, this would include the date of marriage to Joseph Smith. Then I would need all the data about the woman, her birth date, death date, full marriage history, names of husbands, just to sort them out, to understand which woman was which. Often, a woman's polygamous man was a secret, especially in Nauvoo, and so in contemporary diaries, she is not known by the polygamous marriage name. Smith's plural wives were never known as Sister Smith in contemporary records. In the entry above, Priscinda Zina, she uses the first name. And so the full name of Priscinda is Priscindia Lathrop Huntington Buell Kimball. And the other is Zina Diantha Huntington Jacob Smith Young. Okay, and they were sisters. And Zina, of course, later became General Relief Society president. And both sisters were very close friends of Eliza R. Snow. Eliza's an interesting case. Technically, her name would be Eliza R. Snow Smith Young. But she was known throughout her life as Eliza R. Snow, despite her marriages to Smith and Young. Sometimes she signed her name Eliza R. Snow Smith. I don't know that she ever signed her name Eliza R. Young. That she lived in the, Lion House, you know, as a accepted wife of Brigham Young, but she never went by that name. but sometimes she would go back to Smith, use the Smith name. To understand a woman's marriage names, I found that you needed to do more than simple genealogy. You needed to find the stories behind the marriages. So I began to collect any autobiographies, diaries, biographies of these women, along with standard historical sources such as birth or marriage records, newspaper stories, and I created a residence record for these women. So as I started this list, it turned into little biographies, and then the little biographies turned into bigger biographies. And I eventually came up with 33 women whose plural marriages to Smith during his lifetime were supported by solid evidence, in my view. In a separate list, I compiled 10 or so names of women who were possible wives of Joseph Smith. And so, but I excluded them maybe from an excess of caution because there's some good evidence for them. Sometimes there were knotty tangles of documentation relevant to these women's marriages and lives. The riddles were not just secret polygamous marriages. I found that many of these women did not have death dates or birth dates. An equally annoying problem was women who had two or three birth dates or death dates each, you know, which I thought was too much of a good thing. Okay? There were also puzzles related to these women's children and husbands. Puzzles simply led to more puzzles. And one fascinating element in Smith's plural marriage practice was polyandry, in which a woman was married to Smith but stayed married to her first husband after the plural marriage ceremony to Smith. Okay, this greatly complicated my attempts to come up with full names clearly reflecting marriage history for these women. And so, for example, this is out of order, but let's look at Patty Sessions for a minute. And she was in those Eliza R. Snow quotes, Sister Sessions. And so this is Patty Bartlett Sessions Smith Perry. She had been born Patty Bartlett to Enoch Bartlett and Anna Hall Bartlett in 1795. She married David Sessions in 1812 at the age of 17, and they had a large family. She married Joseph Smith polyandrously on March 9th, 1842, but continued to live with David Sessions. So you see, getting a residence history was crucial here. She became a widow in the Smith marriage on June 27, 1844, when Smith was killed, but her marriage to Sessions remained. Okay, she became a widow in her Sessions marriage in 1850, and then the next year she married John Perry. Okay, so it is difficult to write her name in a way that captures her marriage to David Sessions. Patty Bartlett Sessions Smith Perry makes it sound like she married Smith after parting from Sessions, which didn't occur. Okay, so I was running across these interesting, fascinating problems, you know, and getting, all I wanted was just a little, you know, a good, reliable list of Joseph Smith's wives. I began to find diaries, letters, and autobiographies of these women in the Huntington. Okay, and one of whom is Eliza Partridge Smith Lyman. And I found her diary, Eliza Partridge's diary, and it was a beautiful, haunting diary written in a gentle, precise style, documenting a struggle for survival in South Central Utah and a husband who was often absent. One example of Partridge's style: her sons Platt and Joseph settled San Juan County via the famous Hole in the Rock route over the Colorado River, one of the epic adventures in Utah history. And next year, Platt came back to take her to San Juan. And Eliza wrote, and this is up on the screen, "We had a very cold and uncomfortable time on the first part of the journey, but more pleasant and comfortable after we crossed the Colorado. The road was as bad as could possibly be and be traveled over at all. But the Lord preserved us from accident, and we arrived in safety at our journey's end." And her daughter, Lucy Zina, in the same company, wrote, "We camped at Hole in the Rock on the Escalante Desert for the horses and cattle to rest. We made bread for a week's travel using only shad scale for wood. I put a loaf under my pillow at night to keep it from freezing, but next morning it was frozen solid." Okay, so as I began reading these diaries and memoirs, they were very, very moving, and I got attached to these, women. And I began writing these longer biographies. Okay? When I was about halfway through my time at the Huntington, I received a gentle shock. I was contacted by Maureen Erzenbach Beecher, the authority on Eliza R. Snow in the LDS historical community, and it turned out she had already been transcribing the diaries of Eliza R. Snow. And so we talked it over, and I switched to doing The Plural Wives of Joseph Smith, and then I kind of helped her with checking some things in the diaries at the Huntington, and we became good friends, and she really helped me with In Sacred Loneliness. By the time I finished my time in the Paradise for Scholars, the Huntington, I was committed to writing a book about the plural wives of Joseph Smith. I was now engaged in an all-consuming historical detective quest, combined with strong emotional bond with 33 remarkable women. Readers will readily appreciate what a brilliant career move this was. Okay? Writing a book on early Mormon polygamy was the perfect way to get a job teaching ancient Greek and Latin, of course. Okay, so I will summarize some more things. Let's see. Oh, you need the... Here's Eliza Partridge, Smith Lyman. And you love these pictures. And here's Patty Bartlett. You saw that already. Just a remarkable woman. She left a remarkable diary. Okay, now I'm just going to summarize what I did after I got the start at the Huntington. And I guess there are two sections to the story. And one is just continuing research for years. And the other is getting the book published. And people ask, how do you get your sources? And mainly you go to libraries, go to special collections and see if they have anything written by these women or by people related to these women. And one drawback, I guess, in a way it's a drawback, in a way it was a wonderful experience, was writing a collective biography instead of a single biography. If you're writing a biography of a single person, often you can pick a person who has really good diaries and is very well documented and just have your focus on that one person and get the book done. And however, I was writing about 33 different women, okay? And some of them were well documented, like Eliza R. Snow. She left diaries, lots of writing, lots of letters. And others were under-documented. No diaries, no letters, no autobiographies. And an example of it is this woman right here. Elizabeth Davis, Goldsmith, Brackenbury, Durfee, Smith, Lott. How many marriages is that? Five. Her maiden name was Elizabeth Davis. And so she was one of these underdocumented women, and I had been working on In Sacred Loneliness for quite a while. I'd gone to a lot of archives. I did a lot of work in LDS Church archives downtown here, and I could not find a death date for this woman. She was in Nauvoo, and there's kind of a brief reference to her in Utah, and then she just drops off the face of the map. Okay, and she never wrote a thing that I could find. I have found nothing at all that she ever wrote herself. And one day I was sitting at home, at my studio apartment in Santa Monica, and just thinking of strategies. How could I find out more about this woman? And her first marriage was to Goldsmith, who died, and then her next marriage was to Brackenbury, who also died. But she had children with Brackenbury. And you can trace these Brackenbury children in Nauvoo and so on. And I thought, that's kind of a rare name, and we have these sons. They might have had children. What if I tried to find out, some information from some Brackenbury descendants? And so I just called the Utah phone assistance line and said, do you have any names Brackenbury? And they said, oh, yeah, we have a couple. So they gave me these phone numbers. So I called one of the first one, you know, his last name was Brackenbury, and asked him, do you know anything about this woman, Elizabeth Davis, Goldsmith Brackenbury Durfee in Nauvoo? And he said, well, you know, I have an aunt, an old aunt, who has done a lot of work on genealogy. Let me give you her phone number. And that's typical of a lot of families, right? You have one person who does this. And so he gave me a phone number, and I called up this woman. She answered the phone. And so I gave her the name of this person, Elizabeth Davis Durfee in Nauvoo. And I said, do you know anything about her? And she was this sprightly, friendly voice and said, oh, yes, she after Nauvoo, she went to California with her sons, and they joined the RLDS church. And I said, why haven't I heard about her? And she said, well, she went back to taking her Brackenbury name, using her Brackenbury name. Okay, just to confuse genealogists and historians. And then these Brackenbury sons went back to where the RLDS church, Community of Christ, now known. Back then it was RLDS. And one of her sons became, you know, a fairly prominent person. He was a pastor in one of the churches in Independence, in Independence, in Missouri. And I said, do you happen to have her death date? He said, oh, yeah, she died on such and such a date after she was run over by a train in Kansas, which is close to Independence. So that's one example of the challenges of working with some of these underdocumented women. And but it's kind of exciting also to have these underdocumented women and kind of try to bring them to life. So that was an exciting part of my research. Quickly on the publication, let me just say, I explored different options, but we ended up with Signature Books here in Salt Lake. And I had a really good experience with them. You know, they were 100% behind the book. I have a quote from Ron Prittis. Let's see if I can find it real quick. As I was writing this paper, it was really fun to me to try to reconstruct my history and what I did. And I, you know, sent some emails to Gary Bergera and Ron Prittis. And Ron sent me back a whole email about what it was like from their point of view. And this is one of the things he wrote. He said, the project occurred over a period of about 6 to 9 months. Everyone's involvement staggered somewhat, but overlapping in the middle. In other words, Gary Bergera did his thing and passed the manuscript on to me, but didn't discontinue his involvement. And they were working with different chapters of the book. I passed it on to Connie Disney and Brent Corcoran, but I didn't discontinue my involvement in editing ad copy and so on. It went to Janie Fleet, who afterward continued to proof other things related to the book, and then to Boyd Payne for marketing and Greg Jones for shipping review copies and filling orders. But if you see my point, for a couple of months, it was all hands on deck, everyone working to produce and promote your book. He was writing this to me. This was my first book, and it was difficult. You know, it was very difficult to me. I didn't know what to expect. And you know, when you're editing something and sending edits back and forth, and it goes, you know, it seems to go on and on and on, and it was very difficult to do for me. I remember those, you know, those final months as hard. And I was inexperienced with doing this, and I remember. It seemed like it was getting toward the end, and Gary contacted me, and he said, you know, you're going to have pictures for this book. And I went, pictures? Pictures? What are those? And so he said, oh, here's the technical specs, you know, for the photos you're going to need. And I was, you know, like, not being a technical person, my eyes glazed over. And so after that, I knew that when you're doing your research, you know, when you're going for documents, you go for you know, you get the pictures too. The pictures are in the same place. But I didn't know it. I didn't know it then. So that was, you know, I in a rush, I was able to get some really wonderful pictures. And a lot of descendants helped me. I got this photograph here from that woman who I talked to in Utah. Let's see. Okay, that's the end. Descendants helped me. You know, there were some good photographs in libraries, and so we got a wonderful photograph section. But that's just a funny story about how inexperienced I was. Okay, and so I'll read your final paragraph of this, and please get the book and read the whole essay and the whole book. Okay, here's the last paragraph. The book appeared for sale in mid-December 1997. The series of improbabilities and accidents that had made it possible for me to receive a Huntington Fellowship in 1992 had led to my creating tentative lists of Joseph Smith's plural wives, brief biographies of the wives, then longer biographies, marvelous hours of research at many libraries, generous help and encouragement from many friends, editors, historians, archivists, descendants. And I should say, this is one of the things that really hit me as I was researching this article, is how much I owe to a lot of people who helped me. And often, you know, there was no really good reason for them to help me. It was just pure generosity. And then later I wrote fleshed out narratives of the wives and created an edited, compressed, corrected, published book. My own 5+ year intense involvement with the text of In Sacred Loneliness had ended. It was now appearing in bookstores, and I would soon see if readers experienced what I had to some degree. Thank you.
You'll have to permit me, because I'm in charge, that on Saturday I get to carry my Diet Coke wherever I go. I might be carrying a box of Cheez-Its and, like, stress eating them. And I might be weepy. So I come from a long tradition of Mormon women who, the apocryphal story in my family is, it skips every generation. So you come up to the pulpit and you cry all over everything. And so I grew up as a girl, like, my mom was the crier. And so I was like, yes, it's going to skip me. But not today. So people cannot know how much Todd's work in general has affected me. And, I mean, I don't tell this story very much at all. But even, you know, I had the opportunity to meet the Bundy family, right? The Bundy family invited me down to meet them, and we had a conversation that started a chain of conversations about people of color and immigration and Native Americans, and I was able to navigate that conversation so successfully, I think, and in integrity with what I believe because of Todd Compton's Frontier Life. I knew a lot about Jacob Hamblin, and we had a huge discussion about Jacob Hamblin, and so you just can't know, like, all the weird ways your work is helping. So because of that, I've written a love letter, and then I know you all have questions for Todd, so I'm going to read the love letter, and hopefully it skips a generation. Let's see. And just for those who don't know, the reason why I am writing a creepy love letter and reading it to all of you is I run a podcast about plural marriage, so the majority of the work that I do has been completely shaped by this book. Dear In Sacred Loneliness, I've been struggling with what to write you. I know things have changed, and I'm not the same person who fell in love with you when we first met. I have changed, it's true. When I first discovered you, we spent every day together. I was an eager lover. I pored through your pages with the commitment and passion of a new friend discovering a world that you introduced to me. When we first met, you were a revelation, an oasis in a desert of pain and confusion. I was lost in longing to understand why and how to make sense of a theology in heaven I couldn't recognize as home. I've been traveling through my own wilderness, and I finding you felt like walking through hours and hours of sand when all of a sudden on the horizon things began to change. You were shattered glass in sand, a mirror smashed with the shards buried and glimmering in the distance. As I got closer, it was like discovering treasure, slowly dusting off the first layer of dirt, only to find you went deeper and deeper and deeper. As I spent more time with you, I felt like my hands got sore from bleeding and digging. Would I ever be able to excavate you? Could I take all of these pieces of you and build them back to a mirror that would reflect back to me the comfort of the world that I once knew? Just how deeply settled in this desert are you? My fingers became weary from pushing away the soil, sifting each layer, only to find that that shovel after shovel, you just kept revealing yourself to be bigger and bigger and deeper and wider. You weren't a mirror at all. You were an entire house with a door and windows and a garden with a fence and rooms and rooms and rooms that held the mothers of my faith. After many weeks with you, you had revealed to me a foundation that felt long lost and buried to me. I couldn't rescue you from your resting place because you were much too heavy to carry. I tried. I thought maybe I could bundle you tight and keep you quietly sleeping where I found you. Maybe I could possess you and contain you so as not to rumble with the ways you revealed to me like a seer where my pain was. The Buddhists always say, pay attention to the wound. That's where the light comes in. And as I unearthed you, the broken pieces scratched at the wounds and bruises that were always below the surface. It was painful. You hurt me. But it wasn't you after all. It was me. You only spoke to the ache in my heart. You didn't create it. You'd whisper to it the truths that would wrestle me into growth. So I left you in that wilderness and would return to you over and over again. And instead of trying to move you or contain you or escape from you, I realized I would just return to you again and again. I learned to build with you. I learned that I couldn't build without you, that you, with your deep roots cascading down into the sediment of my Mormon identity, that you were deep and strong enough to carry the weight of my pain, my progress, and change. Ever since I knew I'd be part of this session, I've been trying to make a list of all the houses our community has built on the bearings you gave us. Seminal works in our community whose development and appearance couldn't have come into any form of existence without you. Church essays, books, book projects, influential pieces of literature and art and poetry. Dear book, that list is far too long. I abandoned it when I realized it was an impossible task trying to list all the things you have influenced and inspired. I will name some recently, although this list is completely selfish, at its most generous and absolutely horrifically incomplete at its worst. Projects like Year of Polygamy, church essays like I mentioned, countless books, articles, literature, countless blog posts, poetry, art, Leslie Peterson's entire art series, is influenced because of that, and then that inspired so many women to take up art, and it's just the ripples of that are incredible. But for me, it led me on a journey that wouldn't only transform me, it would help transform a town. It led me to Short Creek, where I met descendants of the women whose stories you told. We have helped change a town because of you. Entire communities of thousands of people have shaped their building by you. Though my own podcast project is a selfish project, one that I realized later was never about the people and subject I professed it to be about, but rather about my own relationship to the Mormon marriage system, it is still a project that I am told has had a large influence on contemporary understandings of the subject. I know that the first few years I met you in sacred loneliness, we were together every day, and then slowly we began to drift apart. Like busy partners involved in their own lives, you still had your story to tell, holding the foundation strong. If I told you that even though we don't interact every day like a long-lost friend or a former lover, I have thought about you every single day since we met. I write to you this way because it's as if you are a living, breathing thing, one who whispered new truths into my ears at night before I went to sleep. How could I not hear your voice every day when I interact every day with the lives you touched? It is absolutely not hyperbole to say that those of us who know anything about Mormon polygamy can draw our intellectual lineage to you and your work. In the house you built resides the family with a determined midwife who birthed new worldviews and understandings for us, the stern father who reminded us of the harsh realities of life, that truth has consequences and actions, And also there's the nurturing mother who sat with us and tried to gently shake us into an understanding of who we were and appreciate the love through all the mess that you illuminated for us. You too have lived in the house you made for us. You live as Lady Lazarus, rising the foremothers of our faith from the dead and breathing them into the whisper of life. You, dear book, are so much more than that. You are a scripture and testament to every Mormon woman and the sacrifice of every Mormon woman, because there isn't a Mormon woman that eventually can't escape contending in some way, shape, or form with this practice, God's highest law. I can only speak to the woman's experience because in so many ways I only have a Mormon woman's heart. But I can tell you that you have influenced thousands and thousands and thousands of people, too many for either of us to ever know or count. Even if people haven't held you directly in their arms like I have, they have felt your presence. The ripple effects of your work has impacted everyone here and everyone who will ever engage the subject moving forward. Would you believe me if I told you that I've held the shaking bodies of women, their broken hearts too heavy to hold the sadness by itself? Could you know that my inbox is crowded with thousands of letters that tell me what you've meant to them? Could you see the shadows of yourself holding the resting bodies of 101 living plural wives sleeping in your shade? All of us have been brought together under some Holy Spirit of promise we are all trying to contend with. But, dear friend, you don't just belong only to me. I write to you as if you are a lover because, like a romance, ours has gone through the gratitude of discovery and validation and the grief of anger and pain, contending with a goodbye of comfort. I have hated you and loved you and needed you and rejected you over and over again. So it is with any complicated truth. You are pain and anger and hurt and also love and devotion and light. And I have to wrestle with the wholeness of what you are. When I returned to the house I built on you, I found that I'm still unearthing you in some ways. But I will always live in this place you settled for me. The houses you build will continue to stand long after I know or know better to care about them. Like a true love, you extend beyond time and space in the hearts of those you've touched. In sacred loneliness, I love you. Most sincerely, Lindsay Anson Park.
I must say that I've always been impressed with Todd's scholarship, and I think it's worth mentioning that two of the most seminal books dealing with Joseph Smith, in my opinion, are Linda and Val Avery's book on Emma and this book on Todd's seminal work. And it's interesting to note that both of these works were written by people who were really not trained as historians. I find that kind of ironic that they weren't trained in Mormon studies. I mean, Todd was trained in classical studies, and as Val and Linda say, we were just a couple of housewives who sat down and did this. And that's my comment. But my question is this for Todd. And I guess Lindsay has indicated the profound influence that this book, as well as Linda and Val's book, has had on our modification and bringing Joseph Smith himself into a broader, more feminist-oriented perspective. But my question is this, Todd, were you surprised that you only came up with 33 women that were married? Fawn Brody had come up with a larger number, and I've heard even larger numbers than that. And that's my first question. And one thing you didn't address that I thought was worth addressing your thing is the response or the pushback from officials within the church, because I know you got some flack on that, and you failed to mention that in your presentation.
Okay, that was Newell Bringhurst, and he's actually mentioned in the part I didn't have time enough to read. And Newell encouraged me, you know, as I was starting this research. And we would meet at Sunstone and MHA and so forth. And here's another thing that happened that I remember toward the end. It was Gary Bergera said, do you have anyone you know who might be willing to, you know, give a blurb for the book we could put on the book? You know, and that, it's kind of nerve-wracking for an author to do that. You know, what if this person doesn't like my book, you know? And anyway, I asked Newell to do one of the blurbs, and he did a wonderful blurb. So just one of these many people I really feel like, and I'm glad to be able to thank him right now. And the question was I surprised there were only 33? Well, I looked at those Brody, and Newell wrote the biography of Fawn Brody. And she came up with, 48? But I looked at those very carefully, and I felt like quite a few of them were not reliable. And as I say, one was counted twice, you know. And in fact, it was her. She counted her as Sister Durfee and as Sister Goldsmith or something like that. But as I say, there were 33 who I thought were very solidly documented. And but there were like 10 others who I thought were really good candidates. You know, like I wanted two or three good pieces of evidence for a woman, but sometimes I found one good piece of evidence, and I thought, I need backup to that. But that good piece of evidence is still there. Okay, so, but I think 33 is plenty, you know.
Just a quick comment, Todd. As evidence to go along with Lindsay's, that your book has really made a difference and opened a door that will never be closed again. I worked at Benchmark Books, as you know, for many years. And when your book came out in 1997, as Kurt usually does, he'll put a significant book out on the front counter. And people will come in, and most of our customers are mainstream LDS. And they pick up the book, and I'd be standing there offering to help. And they say, well, what's this book about? And I say, well, it's about at least 33 wives of Joseph Smith. Well, after they got their face back to normal again, shock, they said, oh, no, Brigham Young started plural marriage. Yeah. And so fortunately, you have that little chart in there, which I have copied and carry with me all the time of all the lists and the names and so forth. Excuse me. And I'd show that to them. And it was just, I know there were at least 50 people that I talked to about that. And it was just, it was almost fun for me to see the change that took place in their whole perspective of Joseph Smith. So I just wanted to thank you again for that.
Well, thank you. Lindsay, yeah.
I just want to point this out, that a couple years ago when we were up at the U, we it was when Leslie had her All the Wives of Joseph Smith's paintings hanging up. What year was that? 2016? So our sweet event manager over there, she's like the best. She always she gets to our event after girls' camp. So she's gone for girls' camp, and then she comes and does our event. And she's great, and she puts up with all this weird Mormon stuff, and she's cool. But she comes to me walking in the corridor, and she goes, "Wait, what is that?" And I was like, "Oh, it's the Wives of Joseph Smith, blah blah blah, paintings of the women." And she was like, "Wait, so someone didn't make that up?" And I said, "No, these are real women." And she goes, "He had more than one wife." And I was like, "Oh no, I'm so sorry. No, go away. Don't go to the Sunstone." So I thought that was really funny.
And, you know, this has been kind of a taboo subject for Mormon scholars. And one thing I wrote about was I kind of came up against that, and do I really want to publish this book? And I really decided that it was the right thing to do. But I was, you know, I was a liberal Mormon, but I was attending church and so on, and I realized, you know, this book might have an impact where, you know, the institutional church might not be happy. Okay, and so there's more about that story in there, but I decided it was the right thing to do. And while I'm thanking people, I ought to thank Lindsay. She introduced this book to a whole new generation, and often you don't run across people who have, read your book, whatever you've written. But every now and then I do, and often I say, "Oh, how did you hear about this?" And they said, "Oh, it was through, your polygamy and Lindsay." So. Okay, another question.
What you can do when I'm ripping off their work is sell some books. So.
What evidence, from the evidence that you've gathered, what would you say that you've seen that supports the claim that many of the 33 wives were only patriarchal ceilings?
I haven't found any. Do you mean that we're ceilings for eternity or something like that?
Yes, claims that the women were just sealed to him for eternity and that there was no sexual aspect to it.
I haven't found any good evidence for that. These were marriages you just expect with a marriage that, normally there's sexual relations. If the woman was really old, maybe not. If she was really young, maybe not. I haven't found any evidence that there was an eternity only marriage among Joseph Smith's plural wives. I think they were for time and eternity, it was understood. And I realize other people have different points of view. And some of that point of view got into some of those church essays, I think they're wrong, but I'm glad we're having this discussion about it,
And then a follow-up.
Let me just say my answer to that. So, this is a hotly debated thing, and Brian Hales, for example, argues that there were no sexual component. My understanding, knowing a lot of plural families now, is we can't, in some ways, it's very, very similar to what Joseph Smith was doing and Brigham Young was doing, but in some ways, contemporary polygamy now is really, really different because it's institutionalized. Joseph Smith didn't have the benefit of institutionalized polygamy. He was starting institutionalized polygamy. And so my understanding, and I think would be probably a wise thing, is to keep an open mind that probably every relationship he had with each of the women was different. So I don't know that there was a particular standard at the time.
And then just one quick follow-up to that.
And I think we're running out of time. Maybe we could just bump the person who's in this room next. Do you think that would be okay? Oh, no, it's me. We can't do that.
You can go a little over. I'm sorry. No, that's
fine. No.
It's according to my phone, 9:59, so we don't really have time for any more questions. I hope you'll be able to talk to Todd later. But I do want to point out one thing. Todd's book went from having a lot of criticism from the farms community to being quoted in the church's official essay.